Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to talk about a book called A Life in Wine by Stephen Spurrier. So I'm actually going to skip ahead to the very last page of this book because the way it's summed up is, I think, a really nice way to think about this book and the wine industry aesthetically. Stephen Spurrier, the author, references bottles of wine that are, quote, worth talking about as being simply represented by the three P's, the place, the people, and then the product that is created, and they will each tell their own story. And he takes it one step further and says that the secret to a happy life actually lies in the three S's: someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. And he has been most fortunate in his S's, of course, his initials being Stephen Spurrier. And I thought that that was a really lovely way to sum up this book because it's all about, well, his life in wine. This episode is sponsored by Study Hall, my show on Psalm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for your exams. Not a subscriber? Well, you can get a year of Psalm TV for 50% off with the code STUDYHALL. That's all one word, Study Hall, and you'll get a year's subscription for only $25. So Stephen Spurrier was a pretty dynamic individual. If you were to look him up, he would be described by many, many people in absolutely glowing terms as a wine expert, as a merchant, as a writer, an educator, a champion of French wine, a father, a husband, and I will put this in there, a dog lover as well. So Stephen Spurrier is probably most famous for organizing pretty impactful wine tasting, which we'll get to in a bit. But he had a really long life in wine. And I should go ahead and say this. This book was published in 2020. So it's a pretty recent addition to the wine book diaspora. And if you are looking for the book, this comes from a collection of books called the Académie du Vin Library. And this is actually something that Stephen, a project of his, he founded a wine school, the first private wine school in France called l'Académie du Vin. And later in the book, he actually talks about, along with, you know, friends and colleagues, how impactful wine books were becoming less and less common. And so he established this, co-established this Académie du Vin library to publish wine books. As someone who reviews wine books, yay for that. It's an incredible thing. But the book is hardcover. There's a picture of him. I'm not sure what decade, but based on his clothes and his youth, it's a black and white photo of him. And I would say maybe late 70s, early 80s, based on the width of the tie and his lapels and the color of his hair. But it's a black and white picture. And he's basically sitting on a chair surrounded by bottles and cases of wine. He's got a glass in his hand. He's toasting. It's a great photo. The book itself is 283 pages and it is arranged chronologically. And it's all about his life in wine. And it was published in 2020 or republished. And Stephen actually passed away at the beginning of this year, March 9th of 2021. So it's really sad because this book at the very end goes up to current day, you know, topics. And he even mentions returning to England with the advent of the coronavirus pandemic. And so that's the first time I think I've seen that printed in a published book. And so it's really quite current, but it is also very sad that he did so recently pass away. That said, as sad as it is that he did recently pass away, he lived a very, very full life. And this book details it in incredible, incredible descriptions and photos. There's lots of photos in this book. They are a mixture of black and white and color. And of course, based on, you know, his age and the time that he was working in the wine industry, some of the photos are of better quality than others, but they're really quite lovely. So one of the things that I love most about this book is how it begins. It begins with a section called A Few Words About Stephen, and it starts on page 7. And it goes on through page 41, and it's testaments about Stephen by those who knew him and loved him best. Which, if you're reading this book, or if you decide you want to read this book, what's so interesting is now knowing that he has passed away, you could almost read this as an obituary because you would expect testaments about somebody in this manner to maybe be offered at a memorial. He was still living when these testaments were made, but there's some of the, you know, the who's who of the wine cognoscenti are basically commenting on him. And some of what they say is hilarious. So I had to make a few notes. And I wanted to include just a couple of mentions from that first part of the book. And for each, and these are like a couple paragraphs, they really range in terms of how someone knew him, whether in an academic or commercial sense or even family. And they're all headed up with sort of a little subtitle of how he would be described: a sartorial role model, a respected commentator and wine judge, a revolutionary and a gentleman, around the wine world in nearly 80 years. A longtime friend and confidant. The stories are really, they're hilarious. And you should sort of hope that you would have the opportunity to, or if you had a life well lived, that such things would be said about you. One of my favorite little inclusions, because again, I'll definitely talk about it, but one of the things that Stephen is most famous for is organizing this very disruptive, very impactful wine tasting called the Paris Wine Tasting of 1976, became known as the Judgment of Paris. But in the testament from a gentleman named Ben Halkins, who is a wine marketing specialist and author, he describes Stephen as the most elegant of hosts. I just have to read because it's so lovely. He's talking about how he had dinner with a legendary master of wine in Bordeaux at Chateau Ludden, then swooped down to Monte Carlo, as one does, to see my father, and then back to Paris to spend Sunday night with the Spuriers, Stephen and his wife, Bella. The following morning, May 24th, and by the way, this is 1976, the following morning, outside the apartment building, Stephen and I bade each other farewell. He casually asking, as old friends do, what I was doing that day. And I explained that I was visiting Croft's French agents, Remy Martin. In return, I asked him the same question. Oh, he said, in a gentle, matter-of-fact voice, I've got a tasting arrange. Bit worried about it. Hope it'll work. I want to show the French that other people can also make wine. So if you didn't know what he was alluding to, he had a wine tasting plan that day. Bit worried about it. Hope it would work out. Spoiler alert, it did. And so that event turned out to be, again, as Ben Halkins goes on to say, possibly the most game-changing tasting the wine world has ever seen. And it's just really cute to, I mean, you could never anticipate how it would have turned out. It was a blind wine tasting. But just getting that little snippet and that remembrance of such an impactful tasting is just an absolute riot. And then fast forwarding again to another testament from a master of wine named Fiona Morrison. She describes Stephen as having an eye for Bordeaux's finest. And I will say this, he's an Englishman, and English wine writers and experts and journalists of a certain, critics of a certain age, there's just a tradition for, you know, all roads go back to claret. I believe either Michael Broadbent or Hugh Johnson said that. And it's so true with Stephen. I mean, he spends a lot of time in Bordeaux and is contemporaries, and she makes her way into my best friend, Jancis Robinson. But there's that overlap. There's all roads go back to Bordeaux. Fiona describes a special attribute of Stephen's, which I really love, because sometimes these books can get a little hoity-toity. There's an embarrassment of riches. They're drinking all the greatest wines, all of the greatest estates, and jetting all over the world. And, you know, it's wonderful and amazing. But this book is also really down to earth. And as described, Fiona Morrison is traveling with Stephen, and she describes how he always looks the same, that he's always, you know, well put together. And if he's not wearing a tie, he's got a silk handkerchief tucked in his jacket pocket. And he always emerges from a flight where back in those days, you could bring wine on board. You could actually carry wine on board flight where, you know, everybody else would look hungover and terrible and sleep deprived. And Stephen would emerge smooth and unruffled. And she says his ability to absorb a lack of sleep and excess of wine makes all those who travel with Stephen deeply envious. And it's just really funny. And she goes on to detail how there was a group for almost two decades called La Groupe Spurrier. And it was modified to be called La Groupe Robinson a Spurrier. And it was a group of these influential British experts, critics, wine writers, and they would travel around to the top chateaus in Bordeaux, tasting the brand new vintage. And again, to people who've not had these opportunities, these sort of like work tasting trips, they sound incredibly luxurious and amazing. In actuality, it's maybe not so pleasurable. She goes on to describe that sometimes they were there quite early on a cold March morning without coffee or croissant to revive us. And we waited to be led into a freezing cellar. And the only solace was Stephen's wonderfully cheerful banter. He reminded us how previous vintages had tasted, how a certain rather unpromising vintage has opened up, and he would be the first to bravely comment on the wine in hand while the rest of us desperately twirled our glasses around in hope of prying some fruit and perfume out of a cold, tannic, and stubbornly taciturn wine. And she goes on to describe the things that he would say. But look, when you're on these wine trips or wine tasting visits, sometimes you are tasting over and over and over. And Stephen details the sheer breadth and depth of the kind of tasting. And it makes my mouth just pucker up in like, oh my God, I remember how that feels. And also, so amazing, yet so physically painful after a while. And his ability to absorb lack of sleep and an excess of wine is just what a lovely traveling kind of statement you would say about a friend. So this book is dedicated to wine and to Bella. And Bella is Stephen's wife, and it details his entire life, and especially as he meets her. And this book is very cyclical. Everything kind of comes around full circle, and he kind of retouches and visits on themes throughout his life. And Bella makes a quite regular appearance throughout, from the time where they first met to the time that they were dating, and then when they got married, having children, kind of their whole life together. It's really quite funny. And I think I need to kind of preface the beginning of Stephen's life, or kind of give it a little bit of detail. But he met her when she was 17. And I guess they had met at a party at an ice skating rink, as teenagers might have done then. And so he was pretty shy and didn't have a whole lot of experience with girls. And he followed in the kind of steps of his friends and learned that one of the things that you can do if you're trying to impress a lady is to offer to get her a drink. Some things never go out of fashion. And the girls accepted, you know, at the skating rink. And one of them asked for a gin and orange juice, which in today's language, we might call that gin and juice. And it probably has different connotations. But in those days, that was the favorite drink of Soho's filles de joie, which are good time girls, professional ladies, perhaps. Orange for health and gin to keep up their spirits. And so this was Bella, this is his first meeting of his eventual wife. And he told her that she couldn't possibly order that because it's what tarts drink. And 17-year-old Bella replied, "In that case, make it a double." She had no clue what she was ordering. She just had heard of a drink. And she also was not going to be told what to do on her first evening out. And so they got along right away. And so he says that's the reason that this book is dedicated to Bella and to wine, which I think is really kind of lovely. Don't let anybody tell you what you want to drink. Drink what you want. So we have to talk about Stephen because he had a lot of privilege, and he is also really upfront about that. His family, he originally wasn't planning on going into the wine trade. You know, he went to university and he came into a tremendous amount of money relatively young in his life. His grandfather had a sand and gravel company, and when it was sold, his father just basically let him and his brother know that they should be expecting to receive a check in the mail. No more details were given. And so this was in 1964. So he's in his early 20s. He's a young fellow. And he didn't ask for any more information from his father. He didn't get any more. But in April of that year, he did get a check for £250,000, which would be the equivalent today of over £5 million. So he really kind of started off with a great deal of advantage. And that afforded him a lot of opportunities, but he's very clear about it. And so, yes, he checks his privilege. He's aware of it. But I think he plied it in some very successful and honestly some incredibly unsuccessful ways. So he originally was really interested in art and kind of needed to find, which he didn't actually need to work, but whatever, it's what people do. You need to have a job. You need to have a trade of some sort. And so he ended up in London working as a year's long stagiaire or trainee at one of the oldest and most established wine merchants in London called Christopher's and Company. And after he completed his year-long training, he was informed that he would be sent abroad for 8 months to work for the company's principals, i.e. their major suppliers, throughout France, Germany, Spain, and Portugal. This was in 1965. And because he had just recently come into the sum of money, he let each firm that he would be visiting and training at know that since he would be with them to learn as much as possible and that it considered a privilege, he would not expect to be paid. And he said this proved to be a really astute move. Obviously, other people wouldn't have had that opportunity, but I guess it, by not paying him and just being there to learn, it demonstrated kind of an openness and an attitude, and it did afford him a lot of opportunities. So I can't remember the last time I read a book and just straight up felt jealous about an opportunity that I was reading about. Oh my goodness, what an opportunity this must have been. And again, to have 8 months where you were working, not being paid, just traveling around and learning about all things wine and spirits. Sign me up on that trip. I want to go on it so bad. So I'm probably leaving a few things out, but he started off in Bordeaux working for a couple of their big merchants. And it should be worth noting that in the 60s, a lot of Bordeaux was shipped in, like even high quality Bordeaux was shipped in bulk and then bottled by merchants in London. And so working for Christopher and Company, it was this very established merchant, they would bottle and cork and then sell the wine. And they were very skilled at that. So he went to work with various firms in Bordeaux, Cruz and Calvet, and kind of details working with them and visiting different chateaus in Bordeaux. He then heads north to Cognac and spends a little time with Delamain. Then he goes to the Loire Valley and spends time with Domaine de Beaumard in Anjou. In each of these places, he's learning all about not just their wines, but, you know, in Cognac, he's filling bottles and labeling them, or he's corking things, or he's working in the cellars. He goes to Alsace to work for Hugues Lafisse. He goes to Germany, both the Mosel and the Rheingau. And then he comes back to France through Chablis, through Burgundy, to the Rhone Valley, Châteauneuf-du-Pape in the southern Rhone and Provence. And then Bella comes and joins him because she's his girlfriend. And they spend a little time driving through Italy and Greece. And then they weren't married yet. So it was just sort of little snippets at time that she would join him. And then eventually she comes back to join him when they go into Spain. And there's like just funny stories because her parents are pretty conservative. And even though it was like the swinging 60s baby, like weren't really fond of like their young daughter jetting off to, you know, go spend time with her boyfriend. But then he goes to Jerez, so to Sherry country in Spain, and finally ends up in Portugal, in Oporto with some port houses. All this is detailed and all of the amazing opportunities, and it sounds so wonderful. So I'm in the midst of this like fit of jealousy, reading about all these pages of this opportunity that he has. And then I find myself laughing out loud. I was reading this book at night, like in bed, reading this book, and something made me laugh so hard, I had to text a friend of mine and tell him the story. So I need to set the scene. So when Stephen finds himself in Jerez, he's visiting different sherry bodegas. So sherry, of course, is a fortified wine that comes from Andalusia and is, you know, in the southernmost part of Spain. And most sherry is dry, but some sherry is certainly sweet. And he's talking about tasting through all these fabulous ranges of styles, from the pale finos to the amontillados and the Palo Cortados, and finally the Pedro Ximenez, known as PX, which comes from a grape of the same name. And it's a white grape, but it's dried in the sun till it's basically a little brown raisin. And then it creates this incredibly sweet, viscous wine. It almost looks like molasses. Like it's really deep in color. You'd hardly ever suspect that it came from a white grape. So he's visiting one of these bodegas. And right when he starts talking about the PX, his host, this man named Diego Ferguson, shows him what's called the Jerezano hangover cure. Dipping his Venencia, which is like a wine thief or a pipette. It's basically like a big eyedropper that you dip into a barrel of wine and you can extract a little bit of wine out of it and then pour it into your glass. So he takes a cask of PX in the darkest part of the bodega, dips his Venencia into it, fills a copita and hands it to me. This is the instruction for the Jerezano hangover cure. Tells me to hold on to the cask and down it in one. The explosive impact brought stars to my eyes, but it worked wonders. So here's where I have to tell a little story. So years ago, when I was working for Alinea, while the restaurant was being renovated, we went to Madrid to do a pop-up for a couple of months. And so the restaurant was open for, you know, in a hotel in Madrid for 5 nights a week and booked solid every single night. And then, you know, we actually did have our days off and everybody did different things on their days off. My parents came to visit for a time, or some people wanted to travel around Europe because it's so much easier once you're already there. And I had been to Spain many times before, but there was one part of Spain I'd never been to and was dying to visit. And that was Jerez. And one of the sommeliers I was working with, my friend Devin, was down to go. So on one of our weekends, we finish at the restaurant at like, I don't know, like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. We go back to the hotel where we're all living. We pass by our little neighborhood bar, stop in for a gin tonic. I probably got to bed around 3 o'clock that night. And then we had a train booked the next morning at 7 a.m. So basically took a nap, got up, went to the train station, like took the subway to the train station and got on the train from Madrid, north central Spain, to like the southernmost part of Spain. And I had set up an appointment to visit Bodegas La Gitana, which is Hidalgo La Gitana. So it's a producer in Sanlúcar de Barrameda. So this is where they make Manzanilla sherry. It's a specific style of fino that comes from Sanlúcar. Well, we were really tired, right? Because we'd been working really, really, really hard. We stayed up a little bit too late and we fell asleep and we missed our stop. And we woke up in Cadiz, which is the furthest, it's like the last stop, right? It's like you fall asleep on your commuter train and suddenly you wake up and you're like, I'm in Canada. Well, we were basically almost to Morocco. So thankfully, my friend understood a little bit more Spanish and spoke way better Spanish than I did. And so we navigated buying some bus tickets and we got ourselves from Cadiz to Sanlúcar. And we had a little bit of time to kill. And we were like wandering around, like super pleased with ourselves that we were making such a, you know, like we were just letting Spain take over. And we had found ourselves in this place, this, you know, we'd made our little pilgrimage, but our appointment at the bodega wasn't until the next day. And I used to work for a Spanish chef and his company. And so I've still got some connections, as it were. So I had, you know, texted my Spanish chef friends and I was asking for recommendations for places to eat in Sanlúcar, which on a Sunday is not easy, right? But we found a couple places, amazing places. And you know, like went on whatever, some like website to find a hotel that night, like super fly by the seat of our pants situation. Well, if you've ever found yourself in Sanlúcar, one of the local specialties is this thing called tortilla de camarones. It's basically a handful of baby shrimps, like live, thrown into batter and then cooked into this like big fritter. And you just eat it with sherry and life is good. Like, add that to my list of last possible meals. So we're enjoying that and we're drinking the manzanilla. And I don't know why I felt so big for my britches, but I remember, and it was reminded to me several times, that I was telling Devin that I didn't think it was possible to get drunk off of sherry. That's not true. It's a fortified wine. It's actually very possible to get drunk off sherry. And as we both got drunk on sherry, I realized, you know what? Maybe that's not correct. And he's like, you think? I said, maybe you don't get hungover when you drink sherry. That's also not correct. In fact, you get painfully hungover. So the next morning, I was as rough as I've been in a long time, or had been in a long time, but I was undaunted because I had set up this appointment at the bodega and I was so excited to go. So a little walk around the square helped. A little caña, like a little glass of beer, really helped, you know, hair of the dog. And then we made it to our appointment and sherry brought me back to life, just sipping it. And I suddenly felt instantly better. And I read this about the Jarezano hangover cure. And I was like, oh, sweet baby, in the morning, I don't know what this is. No one told me about it. I must have pulled my stuff together to like look what was going on. But I had to text Devin and he was like, sweet Jesus, a whole copita of PX in a shot? I was like, yeah, how horrible does that sound? But apparently, according to Steven Spurrier, it'll fix you. So there you go. I love that inclusion. You know, since I have been hungover in Jerez, it really, it resonated very deeply. So it was kind of cute. So anyway, there's just these great stories all throughout, you know, Steven's 8-month tour all over Europe. It's pretty incredible stuff. And there's one kind of favorite little inclusion as he and his wife are traveling around. And this comes up frequently about sort of his wife and anyone who works in the wine trade, their spouse or their significant other oftentimes gets to enjoy some of the spoils of the trade. And I know many people in the wine industry who would openly admit that their spouse or significant other might have just as good, if not a better palate than them, even if they've not pursued it as a profession. And I think the same would probably apply to Bella Spurrier. So when she was visiting him throughout his 8-month tour, he describes a little stop when they are in Provence, so in southern France, before heading back to England for Christmas. And Stephen ordered a wine, a Chambon Musigny Les Amoureux 1934 from Domaine Comte Georges de Vogüey, which it sounds like an amazing bottle, amazing producer, amazing vineyard, which, as was expected, magnificent. Towards the end of the dinner, Bella briefly left the table, and my own glass being long empty, I finished the last sip in hers. This has never been forgotten, and Bella has not allowed it to happen again. And this is like the first time he talks about them drinking wine together. It's not the last. And I just kind of love that because he just didn't think that she would notice or care. In fact, she did notice and she cared very deeply. But throughout this whole book, he talks about kind of her impression, her take, and they're usually just these little quips. But he came to be quite a believer in the astuteness of her and really all feminine palates. So as this book moves on, there's a great chapter. I think it's chapter 3 entitled Swinging London. And, you know, he's a dandy. He's a man about town. He has plenty of money and he does describe, as we get into the 60s, as he's back in London after taking his grand tour, how his large inheritance began to slip through his fingers. He said, and he's very honest about it, the decisions were all his, but he always expected the results to be better than they were. He was an easy target. He was a young guy with a lot of money. And so friends and acquaintances who were looking for backings for nightclubs or making a movie or anything like that, he was flattered and tempted. And so he got involved in a lot of really bad business ideas. Now, he had so much money at the time that this is not where he actually hit his big financial pitfalls, but it kind of sets up the scene for the fact that he does encounter some financial hardships. It's not all wine and roses for his entire life. So eventually, after some time back in London, Stephen and Bella decide that they want to live in France. And ultimately, they move to Provence. And he details, it's kind of interesting how this all works out, but they became French citizens for residential purposes. And they lived there for more than a dozen years. First in Provence, they rented a house, but they had to become actual French residents. And there's a little kind of description of how this works from the bureaucratic side. And it kind of shines a light on his like wittiness. And it's this very, I classify it as like dry British wit. And I pick up the same kind of stuff in Jancis Robinson's books, but it's just, he's funny. And it just comes through in this book, and I just love it. So anyway, he's filling out his papers to apply for his residency, and his papers needed to have a justification. His passport at the time listed that he was a wine merchant. He no longer was one. So he just simply said, writer. And of course, the French government official was like, well, what are you writing? And he said, a book. And they said, well, what's the title? And he didn't have any clue. And so he was moving to Provence, which the governmental department that overlaps part of Provence is called the VAR department, V-A-R. And so he had a flash of inspiration when asked for the title of the book, which he was not writing. And he says, with apologies to Thomas Hardy, VAR from the Madding crowd. His papers got signed and they became legal residents of France, and they spent the next 14 years there. So they lived in Provence for a while. Ultimately, they moved to Paris, and that's where I think the main one of his, like, where he kind of rose to fame. So when he moved to Paris, one impactful thing happened, and then followed by another. He had the opportunity to purchase a small retail shop called Le Cab de la Madeleine. And there was like an elderly widow who, you know, kind of, it was in this cute little neighborhood, and he had the opportunity to purchase it. And so he really leaned into this role and became quite respected, relied on a lot of his contacts that he had been building up, and became a wine shop proprietor. He became a wine merchant. And then ultimately, they had the opportunity to expand into the building next door, and along with some folks he brought in, established L'Académie du Vin, which was Paris's first private wine school. And so he really found a passion for not just wine, but also educating people about wine and the idea that people should taste before they buy. And they had themes, and I work for a wine school. And so these tastings, they're really charming to think about, introducing people to, you know, wines from different places. He really appreciated what he calls French country wine, so small producers. As the bicentennial of the United States was approaching, one of the people that he employed and then partnered with for L'Académie du Vin was an American woman. And they had this idea about doing a tasting, featuring American wines for a tasting to celebrate the bicentennial of the United States of America. And of course, that was, you know, 1776 to 1976. And the idea became kind of bigger and bigger, that instead of just doing a tasting of American wines, why don't they make it a blind tasting? And then why don't they compare them with, you know, wines of similar age and sort of the best of the best of France? So you're likely familiar with this story if you're in the wine trade or are interested in wine history. But Chapter 7 details what's called now as the Judgment of Paris. We know how this works out. If you don't, it's going to be a big old spoiler alert. But essentially, he selected wines from California, which was relatively unknown in the 70s outside of the United States, and certainly maybe largely outside of California, relatively unknown, both Chardonnay and Cabernet, and decided to match them up against France's best Chardonnay and Cabernet. And we know what happens in a blind tasting with very illustrious palates, very talented people. In this blind tasting, scoring the best, the United States wines totally upset the best of the best in the world of France. And it really had this huge impact on turning a global spotlight onto the wines of California. And it really, it just changed the landscape forever. We kind of know how it works. There was a movie made about it, Bottle Shock. By the way, Alan Rickman played Stephen Spurrier in that movie. Interesting choice. And Stephen was quoted as saying that the movie was full of a whole lot of untruths and things that never actually were said or done. But it's, you know, if you want to see how loosely it worked out, you can certainly watch that movie. So that movie is obviously a Hollywood take on that. And look, shameless plug, SomTV Network has a documentary on the Judgment of Paris coming out next year. So if you want something a little bit more objective and accurate, perhaps with no artistic license taken, that might be a good one to look out for. So most folks are probably familiar with how this worked, but what's so great about this book and Stephen's role in it is you learn so much more detail about how they got the wines there, because this was something that, while it wasn't hatched on the fly, it was, you know, they had to arrange for the wines to be imported because people weren't importing domestic to the United States wines to France at the time. So we found somebody who was working with these wine tours in the United States, taking people from the US around to some great domains and chateaus in France. And each of those people checked along wine with them. And so they got all the wine to France. And, you know, the list of people invited to be judges is, I mean, it's impressive. It's, well, let's see. The Inspector General of the Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, the INAO of France. Michel Dovaz, one of the early professors to teach academy courses in French. Claude Dubois-Milot from Gomio, which is a food and, well, now it's, it used to just be wine, but now it's a food and wine publication. Odette Kahn, editor of La Revue du Vin de France and its sister publication. She was basically the ruler of the roost among Parisian wine writers, as it was said. a Bordeaux-born chef and owner of a 3-Michelin-star restaurant, the owner of Chateau Giscourt, the third growth producer in Margaux, later Secretary General of the Association des Grands Crus Classés de Saint-Emilion, the head sommelier at the 3-Michelin-star La Tour d'Argent in Paris, Aubert de Villene, co-owner and co-director of Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, and then another owner of a 3-Michelin-star restaurant called Le Taillevent. So really talented people, right? So it details who all these folks are, and then it details the wines. We know who won, right? Chateau Montelena Chardonnay and Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Cabernet Sauvignon. But this book puts it all into context. It lists all of the California wines that were selected with a little bit of information at the time. And if you had asked me, gun to my head, to name all of them, I might not be able to recall. So it's good to see some of these, you know, a little bit more depth of some of these wines that are produced. And then also all of the French wines that kind of went head to head. And there are some funny little stories. So one of the Burgundy, the white Burgundy, the Chardonnay producers that was selected to go head to head with the California Chardonnay producers was the 1973 Domaine Ramonet Batard Montrachet Grand Cru. I mean, this is at the top of a very steep heap of some of the greatest wines in the world. And he does include that a few years earlier, Monsieur Ramonet had been put on the cover of Gomio, that publication, and had pronounced that he had been put on earth by God to make great wine. So he, Stephen Spurrier, chose the 1973 Batard Montrachet to match against four of the California Chardonnays. This is from the description. The wine turned out to be low in acidity and was not well received by the judges. Parenthetically, the following autumn, on a buying tour of Burgundy, I was physically thrown out of the Ramonet cellars by Monsieur Ramonet's son, André, for having caused such an insult to the family name. With great risk comes great reward and sometimes great consequence. So there you go. So it's really funny. And look, it was a huge upset. No one expected, you know, things to happen. The scores were sometimes quite close. I mean, some wines didn't show well, but amongst the top wines, the scores were really close. I mean, Stag's Leap Wine Cellars bested Chateau Mouton Rothschild, but by 1700ths of a point. So it was close, but it was very, very powerful and had a big, big impact. So it's the book obviously has to detail that. And then from there, you know, Stephen's misadventures in the business world are detailed, as are his tasting exploits. And like with a previous review with a book of Jancis Robinson, I mean, these folks have had all the opportunity to taste some of the greatest wines in the world. And sometimes that can get a little bit, not tedious, but you almost start to feel like you've consumed a little bit too much. But he does have a lot of business misadventures. And in fact, a few chapters later, if we fast forward to the 1990s, he says that shortly before his 49th birthday, he returned to London. The brand that he had created over two decades ago had ceased to exist. He was not only broke, but deeply in debt, and the future looked unimaginably bleak. Again, a spoiler alert, he rebounds back. The next chapter is called The Road Back. And he really got involved in wine competition judging and also writing. He worked for Decanter as an associate editor, and he details his travels all over the world for various wine competitions. And I think that's one thing that people think of him in a very appreciative manner for, is that he says his own personal cellar is 90% French wine and a large chunk of that is Bordeaux. He definitely was an expert and a promoter, a champion of French wine. But he also never wanted to stop learning. And he details visiting places that were, I mean, emerging is putting it lightly, because he was a recognized wine celebrity. And so he went to places like the Republic of Georgia or Russia or Virginia and got involved in tastings there and always had something nice to say about the wines. He doesn't dog on anything. He just always thinks about like the enthusiasm of the producers and the questions they ask and their attempt to make great wine. And you just really have to appreciate that, because oftentimes, if you were to look with no context at this gentleman of great privilege and this world in wine, you might think that the stereotype of a wine snob could apply to him. And I don't think it ever did. He definitely had a lot of opportunities to taste amazing wine, but he also appreciated the opportunity to explore and expand his palate. So moving kind of on in his life, there's a chapter, and I love the title of it, chapter 15, The Poacher Turned Gamekeeper, because Stephen and his wife, ultimately after moving back to London, purchased property in Dorset, and he discovered, you know, walking around the property, that it appeared that they had high quality chalky limestone soil. He had his, you know, soil expert friends take a look. He had his, you know, vigneron friends kind of take a look and assess, and all agreed that perhaps this was a place where vines could be planted and wine could be made. And so he launched his own label, Bride Valley Vineyards, named for the Bride River that ran alongside, and produced sparkling wine. And now, I mean, English sparkling wine is still emerging, but is highly regarded. And so he details sort of the trials and tribulations of starting this. And it's so cute. I don't mean that to like say in a negative or like condescending way, but he was discussing his ideas for Bride Valley Vineyard with a colleague. And he told them, you know, his intention was to make one single wine, just a single vintage Brut style wine. No rosé, no blanc de blanc, no non-vintage wine like they would do in Champagne. And his friend says very bluntly that this was a really stupid idea and that he had to make at least two wines, if not more. And Stephen said, why? His assumption was that his model was simplicity itself. And his friend Georges said, because with just one, the only question you can ask someone is, do you like my wine? Whereas with two or more wines, the question can be, which of my wines do you prefer? Very sage advice. And so he, you know, England is not the easiest place to grow grapes and make wine. And he details issues that they've had, certainly, and varying production and weather and climate variation. But Bride Valley Vineyards is an established producer of English sparkling wine. And so it is kind of a lovely story how his trajectory in the world of wine has moved from, you know, apprentice and stagiaire and merchant to speaker and to teacher and to judge and to critic and world traveler and bon vivant for sure. And then ultimately a winemaker. You know, it's just really cute. He was honored. I mean, he's been honored at just about every possible wine organization and publication that existed. But he talks about how even at that point, he found himself like stressing and fretting about the conditions at vintage and was like talking to the proprietor of some like major chateau in Bordeaux. And the guy just kind of like put his arm on his shoulder and was like, welcome to the club, man. Welcome to the club. Of course, he didn't say it like that. He's French. But it's just kind of a nice idea to think about how his whole circle of world and wine kind of concluded. So this book, it's like I said, it is his life in wine. So what works? Literally everything. This is funny and it's charming and it's great historical references. Even for someone who is familiar with Stephen Spurrier and his contributions to the wine world, I learned so much more about him and have so much more of an appreciation for him. It makes me sad that I never got the opportunity to meet him. But I feel like at least in the ephemera of the wine world, like we kind of cross paths theoretically because he would be like a featured guest at events that I've been a volunteer sommelier for in later years. Or I volunteered as a sommelier judge for the Governor's Cup, which assesses Virginia wines. And Stephen was the chairman of the Governor's Cup for years because he was touting Virginia wine. So there's some like loose connections because the world of wine is small, but I never had the privilege of making his acquaintance, which makes me really sad. Shameless, again, plug for the Somm TV network. It is detailed, of course, that the producer, the creator of Somm TV, a young American filmmaker, Jason Wise, is detailed and named in this book because, of course, The Judgment of Paris was recreated in a manner with Stephen Spurrier, Jancis Robinson, and also a kind of a parallel tasting with sommeliers in New York. And it was detailed in Somm 3. So it's all roads, you know, lead back to Bordeaux, but also in the end, they all come into one. And I guess a river runs through it. It might be the Bride River. It might be the Garonne. It's really hard to say. So what doesn't work? Very little. I guess maybe, and I would levy the same general criticism against some of Jancis Robinson's books, that sometimes the impressive detail of the many, many fabulous dinners and tremendous bottles consumed that obviously I'll never have the opportunity to consume those. It can maybe get a little bit tedious. Mostly I'm just jealous, but it's well-written. He's got a great way with words. He's a fantastic writer. It's just, yeah, there's very little that doesn't work. Even the pictures, even the black and white ones, they're clear and they're beautiful. Here we go. Maybe one small thing. I see this with a lot of books. The cover has like a red cloth spine, and then the hardback cover has this like kind of matte cover that occasionally your little greasy paw prints can leave some fingerprints on it. I see this with a lot of wine books. It's just books generally. Maybe it's because, I don't know. I don't know why it is, but it's just a cover. But on the plus side, it has my favorite characteristic of any wine book, which is a built-in bookmark. Just a little ribbon that is sewn into the spine. So even if I'm struggling to find any kind of flaw, it's always far exceeded by all of the positive attributes in this book. So my recommendation for this book, this is 100% buy. It's historical, it's educational, it's entertaining, and it details one of the great people in the world of wine and also very, very impactful events in the world of wine. I think that this has a broad appeal to a lot of different people and it dots all the I's and crosses all the T's. I really, really enjoyed this book. So I think you should go buy it. It would make a lovely addition to your personal wine library. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe. Hey, if you like what you've heard, leave us a rating. We'll see you next week. This episode was brought to you by Study Hall, my show on Somm TV, where you can learn the ins and outs of being a sommelier and get helpful hints and tips for studying for all your exams. Get a year of Somm TV for only $25 with the code STUDYHALL.